a fantastic game, and the first question is about the penalty, he grumbled. His poor results in previous years had clearly irked him, but now an important step to represent Borussia Dortmund differently in the Champions League had been made. It was one of the best games I've ever seen, and I've seen a few, Klopp had told 442 a few weeks later. We were almost terrified out there at how perfectly our plan came together. Maybe one day, this night will be remembered as the team's European birth, wondered Die Welt. Klopp's football had been proven feasible outside German borders too, at last. To be honest, Manchester City was shit that year, not very strong, Watzke shrugs. Their team was slow, overweight, I don't know. But Dortmund also took 4 points from 2 games versus Real Madrid and qualified for the last 16 as group leaders. They truly had arrived. We're a little surprised that everybody else is surprised about that, Zorc said, a little indignantly. Subotic puts the improvement in 2012-2013 down to greater collective intuition. You can practice being ready to counterpress and win the ball back, the mindset, but you can't train the exact movement because you don't know where you'll lose the ball on the pitch. Everybody had both the power and responsibility to act as the trigger, then everybody had to join in. Getting the right feel for it took a couple of years. Then it became a natural reaction, a reflex. Dortmund had little trouble dispatching a leggy Shakhtar Donetsk in the next round. It's always good to get Russians or Ukrainians then. They're still on a winter break, Watzke says. But Malaga in the quarterfinals was a very different story. Borussia were 2-1 down on aggregate at home in the second leg after 90 minutes. What happened next would go down as the miracle of Dortmund, Klopp. The black and yellow scored twice in injury time, the second from an offside position, to edge the Spaniards 3-2. The signal in Duna Park erupted, spewing out happiness like molten lava. I ran onto the pitch, hugged Marco Reus, and never wanted to let go again, Gundogan remembers. It was the craziest moment of my football history for sure, Subotic says. That was something straight out of a Hollywood movie. We knew we could get one goal and then just push and see if we can get lucky. Luck was on our side that day. It's crazy. Just crazy what happened in this stadium. Klopp shook his head, bewildered by the turn of events, before he hugged Marcel Schmelzer in the mixed zone. Rarely has a football team been seen as so united and enthralled with themselves, Süddeutsche Zeitung wrote. Dortmund were in the semi-finals of the Champions League. It's phenomenal. People here are as happy as if they had a second hole in their backside, Klopp diagnosed. The madness of Malaga, an unforgettable moment of otherworldliness, was one of those stories that will still be told in 20 years' time, Klopp told author Christoph Biermann a few months later in his book, Wenn wir vom Fußball träumen. My motivation as a coach is to collect that kind of stuff for people to tell and retell it. That's what this club is about. Its most important pillar is made up from the stories it has written since its foundation. That's also the reason why I love experiencing this time here so much. It gives us the chance to write such stories. Football, he added, was a shared collection of stories, a shared history, an identity. You win and you lose, but you're with the people you like. You're at home, you belong. That's what we all want. 10 million people want to belong here. The next chapter pitted the black and yellows against Jose Mourinho's Real Madrid. 2 nights before the first leg, on the stroke of midnight, Gundogan was on his mobile phone looking at a headline that didn't seem to make sense. I had this routine. I would read Bild online before going to bed, he says. Next day's articles went live after 12 a.m, and there it was, in big, fat letters. Götze is moving to Bayern. I texted Marco Reus. Him and Mario had the same agents and were best friends. Can this be true? Yes, I've known since yesterday. I had trouble believing it. Götze, 20, was the wunderkind of German football, the talent of the century, Sammer. He had been with BVB since he was 8 years old, a symbol both of their renaissance under Klopp and the promise of an even greater future. Dortmund had resigned themselves to losing the odd player each year, but not a true Dortmunder. Not Mario. Everybody was in shock. Some of the players couldn't sleep, Klopp told The Guardian. It was like a heart attack. I couldn't speak. I couldn't go out with my wife that night. Bayern had exercised a 37 million euro release clause, Bild reported, to make him the first big-name signing of the Pep Guardiola reign, which was to start later that summer. But who had leaked the story and why at such a sensitive time? 48 hours before the tie against the Spanish ensemble of superstars. Suspicions quickly fell on the Bayern hierarchy. Their signing of Götze was a classic Bayern power play. Why should they mind if news of the transfer further unsettled their domestic rivals ahead of a hugely important match? Bayern tried to destroy us, Watzke later claimed. Whether the Bavarians were really the culprits is uncertain, however. Dortmund had known about Götze's decision 12 days before, and it's quite possible a third party, say an agent representing a player negotiating to join Bayern next season, or a thwarted club who'd also shown an interest in Götze, spilled the beans without malice aforethought. Bayern had their own semi-final against Barcelona to contend with, and could have done without the controversy. The forward's release clause, in any case, had to be activated by the 30th of April. Either way, Klopp was left emotionally the worse for wear by the prodigy's defection south, Watzke says. He found it hard to accept that Mario wanted to leave, that he wanted to join up with Guardiola. That turned out to be the mistake of the century, and Klopp had foreseen it. He knew, he was 100% convinced, that the lad was making an error. It hurt him. The kid that he had brought through was leaving. He told him it was a mistake in a meeting, just the two of them. We met with him and his agent too, Klopp repeated. You're making a mistake. But the decision was made. That played a lot on Klopp's mind. But in the sense that he was worried about Mario, not about the team. Gundogan remembers a few ultras turning up at the training ground, looking to make their displeasure known. Klopp played it cool. He said that he regretted Mario's decision, but that it was a normal thing in football, and okay, and that the show had to go on. Mario was still our player until the end of the season, and he was convinced that he'd do his best, and that was it. I explained to Mario that people will definitely not forget him moving to Bayern Munich, Klopp said after the final whistle. But they will be busy with other things tonight, because the club is the most important thing. Fortunately, that's what happened. The atmosphere put everything I've ever experienced in the shade. Having sown passion for almost 4 years, Klopp reaped pandemonium that night. Madrid were buried under a deluge of screams and attacks, barely escaping their footballing lives after an epic 4-1 drubbing. Neither Götze nor his teammates had been adversely affected by the Bild story, as Dortmund completed a hugely impressive Bundesliga double over La Liga. Bayern had beaten Barcelona 4-0 in their first leg. A showdown in the final in North London beckoned. More bad blood, too. Robert Lewandowski, scorer of all 4 goals against the Spaniards, had agreed terms with Bayern to accompany Götze on his move to the Allianz Arena, a piece in Der Spiegel had alleged just before kickoff. The Polish striker and his camp did nothing to quell the speculation. We intend to change clubs this summer, agent Mike Bartel was quoted as saying. Lewandowski's contract at Dortmund expired in the summer of 2014. Klopp diffused the situation with self-deprecating humour, reminding reporters at the Signal in Duna Park that he, too, had scored 4 goals in a game once, at Erfurt. But deep down, he was much more troubled than he let on, Watzke reveals. Robert Lewandowski was an issue that bugged him in the extreme. We couldn't quite agree either. Should we have sold him in 2013 or let him leave in 2014 for free? Jürgen was more of a mind to sell him, but Robert is a professional, like very few others. He's not the emotional type. He'll never kiss the badge, but to have him in your team is a gift. He's like a machine. Nevertheless, Klopp was quite annoyed with the way things went down. All of us were angrier and more upset that we lost these players than we led on. Once you admit that, people immediately accuse you of moaning. There was no time for that in May 2013. History beckoned. Dortmund versus Bayern, a Bundesliga derby on the hallowed turf of Wembley. German football has arrived in the present after learning from the past, cheered Süddeutsche Zeitung, outlining how both teams' tactical sophistication, inspired by the great historical sides, Ajax, Milan, Barcelona, had taken them to a first-ever all-German final in the Champions League. Klopp's injection of energy in particular, Frankfurter Rundschau claimed, informed a new German school of football. He has reinvented the old, physical game of German teams, feared and despised in equal measure, paired with strategic finesse and technical maturity. There was another plot line, the final. Klopp explained to a worldwide audience via his Guardian interview, pitted the most interesting football project in the world, the new story, the special story, against a Bayern side behaving like a James Bond villain. Dortmund were rank outsiders in financial terms, football romantics fighting against aristocratic moneybags who didn't just want to beat them, but dismantle them altogether. Klopp, a huge sports film buff. I grew up on movies like Major League. Firmly believe the underdog could carry the day. We're not the best team in the world, but we can beat the best team in the world, he predicted. Dortmund so nearly did at Wembley. A typically full-throttle Borussia hunted and harangued Bayern, took control and created decent goal-scoring opportunities. I remember we should have been 2-0 or 3-0 up after 30 minutes, says Gundogan. Once Bayern had weathered the first storm, the game slowly drifted away from Dortmund. I think it was impossible for us to keep the same pace after the first 45 minutes. It had been incredibly high, Bender says. A Mario Mandzukic goal saw Jupp Heynckes's team take a 1-0 lead on the hour mark. 8 minutes later, Gundogan equalised from the spot. Dortmund were in it again, but felt aggrieved too. Bayern defender Dante, already on a yellow card, was not sent off for fouling Marco Reus in the box. Gundogan. Referee Nicola Rizzoli said, "What do you want? You got a penalty, didn't you?" Bayern, unperturbed, had more energy and class towards the end of the tense nail-biter. Arjen Robben scored the winner in the 89th minute. Klopp and his players were applauded off the pitch by the Dortmund fans. They were gracious losers. "We have to respect Bayern's win," the coach said calmly. "We shouldn't forget that many teams wanted to get to the final and that Bayern shot half of Europe to pieces on the way here." Bayern were that little bit better than us that year, Watzke concedes. But Rizzoli's lenience still rankles. It was a catastrophically bad decision. One out of 100 referees, 99 would have probably sent him off. I'd have liked to see how the game had gone then. Immediately after the match, Klopp had vented his anger in the tunnel, shouting at Pierluigi Collina, UEFA's head of referees. "One or two decisions certainly could have gone the other way," was all he said in the press conference, adding that the pride he felt for his team would soon take centre stage again. In the dressing room, he consoled his tearful players by pointing at the bigger picture. "You know that on a different day, with a different referee, you beat them." But Klopp didn't over-dramatise it, says Subotic. He said, "Remember where we were at the beginning of the season, how far we have come. Did anyone think we would make it to the Champions League final? It's all good, boys. Enjoy the evening." He's the man who sets the mood. For the club, for the team, for everybody. Especially at such testing times, when everybody's looking for a bit of direction. Klopp's philosophical take paved the way for a great post-match party at the Natural History Museum, Josef Schneck says. After a while, nobody was thinking about the defeat anymore. We've always been pretty good at partying. Looking back, Kiel wonders if Dortmund winning at Wembley might have been too much of a fairy tale. "Nobody would have liked to have seen that movie. It would have been unrealistic crap," Klopp told Bierman. A little later, in an interview for UEFA.com, he wasn't so sure anymore, however. "It would have been crazy if we had won the Champions League last season," he said. "I think we would have lost our minds. It would have been an incredible story. I would love to have watched that story if it was a movie. A story like, I don't know, the Cleveland Indians in Major League. The Dortmund Indians. But it really would have been very crazy. So that's why everything is okay and still very special. And there's still a lot of time for us to win even more." Chapter 12, Chaos and Theory. Liverpool 2016 to 2017. The Reds' 2016 pre-season tour to the US offered a long overdue chance to work on fundamentals. At least one of the daily double sessions was devoted to detailed tactical drills. Members of the LFC press corps were so impressed by the complexity of some of the choreographed exercises on show on the Stanford University pitch that they questioned whether training should be in fact open to the public at all. The journalists were used to Premier League coaches hiding their trade secrets behind 10-foot walls, fearful of spies sent by rivals. Jurgen Klopp had no such qualms. When the German heard of the reporters' concerns, he put on his best silent movie comic, "I don't understand what you're talking about, face." That's kindergarten stuff, he'd say to the LFC staffer, waving an imaginary fly away. I don't think for a second that Arsene Wenger will be surprised by any of that. The Frenchman's team, Arsenal, were Liverpool's opponents on the opening day of the coming season, when LFC won 4-3. A critical appraisal of Klopp's first 8 months on Merseyside had earmarked three areas ripe for an upgrade. The first one, the obvious need for a much more thorough and systematic implementation of the coaching staff's main idea of play, was at last addressed under the Californian sun. An absence of European engagements during the season would offer more time for match preparation. The squad, a mishmash of genuine talent, loyal stalwarts, and speculative investments that hadn't quite come off, was added to by the arrival of Bundesliga centre-backs Joel Matip and Ragnar Klavan, goalkeeper Loris Karius from Klopp's alma mater Mainz 05, all-action midfielder Jorginho Wijnaldum, Newcastle United, and Southampton's Sadio Mane, a Senegalese striker who had been offered to LFC two seasons earlier for a third of his £37 million price tag, but not been ranked highly enough in the club's technical department's player evaluation model. Thirdly, Klopp and his staff deemed that the Premier League's physical exertions warranted improved conditioning. Andreas Kornmeier, a stubby, bespectacled mini-Klopp, it's funny how they look alike, Adam Lallana laughs, was brought in as head of fitness, and Mona Nemmer was appointed head of nutrition. Lallana, unprompted, says the work of the two former Bayern Munich employees had a discernible positive effect on the 2016-17 season. Putting Mona in there has been unbelievable. She's come and reached new levels with the food we're eating. And Andreas, the fitness coach, comes in and we had a good pre-season under him. He got us fit for how the manager wants us to play, which is demanding. A trip to Wembley in early August offered a glimpse of the exciting prospects ahead. European giants Barcelona, Legi, and behind their English opponents in terms of preparation, were beaten 4-0 by the Reds in the International Champions Cup, a semi-competitive fixture with Mane the star attraction. 24 hours later, however, Klopp's much-changed side crashed to a 4-0 friendly defeat at Mainz, of all places. Spectators at the Opel Arena, many thousands of whom had come to the ground early to welcome their former hero with standing ovations, sent Klopp home with another round of applause after the final whistle. The LFC coach professed himself grateful that his team had accompanied him on his slightly uneasy lap of honour. "It would have been hugely embarrassing for me to run about by myself there," he laughed. "That way, it was cool. My boys showed that they have good manners. Even if they can't play football, they showed their appreciation of the extraordinary atmosphere." The two contrasting 4-0 scorelines, as well as another pair of wildly differing games, a breathless 4-3 win at Arsenal, and a sorry 2-0 defeat at newly promoted Burnley, set the tone for the entire campaign, a riveting, exhausting ride that ended in relief rather than euphoria, just like any other overly long roller coaster. Liverpool were prone to stunning performances against some of the best sides that year, and at the same time liable to suffer embarrassing defeats at the hands of the decidedly lesser lights. That unnerving pattern ultimately precluded a better finish than fourth spot, but in the run-up to Christmas, hope burned brightly on Merseyside that more than an inglorious quarter of a century without a league title might come to an end. Following on from the Burnley reversal, the Reds won against champions Leicester 4-1, future champions Chelsea at Stamford Bridge 2-1, and 10 other sides in an unbeaten 15-match run that briefly took the club to the top of the table and made Liverpool supporters enjoy, well, being Liverpool supporters again, as the Liverpool Echo wrote. "The fans like watching their team. They can't wait to come to Anfield. The sense of the new heightened by redeveloped main stand that's allowing the ground to rediscover a consistent volume not heard in four decades." Gone was the resigned, apathetic silence that had hung over the ground for much of the time since the failed championship challenge in 2014. "We were bulldozing teams," Lallana says. As promised, heavy metal football had arrived. Klopp is the best coach in the world for the spectators. He creates teams that attack the back four, said Manchester City manager Pep Guardiola. Neither the Catalan nor his prominent colleagues José Mourinho, Manchester United, Arsene Wenger, Arsenal, Antonio Conte, Chelsea, and Maurizio Pochettino, Tottenham Hotspur, were able to inflict a single defeat on Liverpool that season. Mane's inclusion gave the attack an extra level of pace and flexibility. The former Red Bull Salzburg winger and his two Brazilian teammates, Philippe Coutinho and Roberto Firmino, constantly switching positions in pre-programmed ways to find a path towards goal, even against sides so deep that their last line of defence is right next to the terrace, as Klopp's chief scout Peter Krawitz puts it. In a celebrated appearance on Sky Sports Monday Night Football in September, the Liverpool coach reiterated his mantra of gegenpressing, being the best playmaker. but at Melwood, the emphasis had quietly shifted from working against the ball to working with it. Liverpool, the coaches, realised, needed better active solutions for those games where they were the dominant side. After getting used to one another in the first season, there was a much bigger focus on possession football for the second year, Crowitz reveals. The idea was to control the pace of the game with the ball and to use the time between games to adopt a footballing idea that could, ideally, be reproduced in a flexible manner under pressure. To that end, the coaching staff spent many training hours getting the team to adhere to certain patterns of movement. While the routine never included precise predetermined runs, it consisted of agreed procedures, Crowitz, for creating spaces in the specific areas where opposition teams were suspected to be most vulnerable. One such procedure, for example, entailed two players dragging their opponents away from the centre with dummy runs, thus clearing a channel for the third one to run through on goal unopposed. A simple enough move, but very effective if executed in perfect synchronicity. Crowitz. The system by itself is not really important in football. The point of coaching is to try to make football a game based on many random events. Less random, to force your luck in a sense. My favourite quote is by Lukas Podolski. Football is like chess, but without dice. I changed that slightly to make it, football is like chess, but with dice. What I mean by that, every coach spends an incredible amount of time pondering about all the different factors, about the opponent, the weather, and so on, knowing full well that total control of the ball is unattainable. All you can really do then is to find a general order, a system of orientation for your own players that brings out the best of your specific squad. Successful combination football depends on two people having the same idea at the same time. One has the ball, the other starts making a move. A coach's job is to practice these sequences to instill an idea, repetition, and situations to increase the chance that they will work under real live conditions when there's pressure and an opponent interfering. The alternative is to rely on total individual quality, on being simply superior. But that's not our approach. We can't afford these players. We've never been able to afford these players at any of the clubs we've worked for. That's why the idea always takes precedence for us. In those golden autumn months, the succinctness of Klopp's playing concept threatened to trump all rivals, most of whom had trouble making most of their players' potential. Whereas Liverpool's last title challenge under Brendan Rodgers in 2013-14 had owed much of its drive to one superstar striker, Luis Suarez. This was a true team, moving and playing as if connected by invisible nerve cords. In the slipstream of strong showings, players who had long been written off suddenly shone. James Milner, one of the most important leaders in the dressing room, was reinvented as a left back. It was cool to see that players who had already played hundreds of Premier League games were ready to try out a different style, to adapt to it, Crowitz says. Centre-back Dejan Lovren was another player who confounded his critics. When we came to Liverpool, everybody told us about his problems, about the things he couldn't do, but we were determined to look at him and everybody else with fresh eyes, says Crowitz. We felt from the very first day that we had a player here and his development has been great. I think a new coach trying out new things and different players taking responsibility for any failure was seen as a chance by many to improve their situation. And many have seized it. Adam Lallana and Roberto Firmino, who found it easy to adjust to the new tactics due to their past at pressing Bastian Southampton and TSG Hoffenheim respectively, emerged as real pillars of the side, as did veteran midfielder Lucas Lieva. His experience, footballing intelligence, communicative skills and ability to learn made the Brazilian a key part of the new setup. Klopp had insisted on his first day at Anfield that Liverpool weren't nearly as bad as vast sections of the media and their own supporters feared. Maybe the squad itself has started feeling that way too. He would sometimes get frustrated, telling us that we don't believe how good we are, Lallana says. The coach and his staff also feel that the public in England are generally too quick to make up their mind about players and too slow to revise their views in light of evidence to the contrary. Crowitz. Once they have convinced themselves, for example, that a goalkeeper is shit, he remains shit for eternity. They will wait as long as it takes until he does make a mistake and then say, "See, I told you so." It's a self-fulfilling prophecy in a negative sense. It's quite prevalent here. A late blunder from Loris Karius in the 4-3 defeat at Bournemouth in early December put an end to Liverpool's unbeaten run and led to the young German getting dropped for Simon Mignolet for the remainder of the term. The timing of the awful result, the Reds had been 3-1 up with 15 minutes to go, couldn't have been much worse either. The team was scheduled to fly to Spain for a Christmas party. Klopp was unperturbed, however. When we landed in Barcelona, music came on in the plane and he got on the microphone. Lallana recalls with a huge smile. He was like, "Listen, lads, if we can party when we win, we can party when we fucking lose." So everyone got off the plane thinking, "You're right, it's time to party. Let's party, let's have a drink." Which just shows there is more to life than football. Yeah, we did our best, we lost. And yeah, it feels shit to lose, but there's more to that. The older you get, I think the more it hurts, but the quicker you get over it. Klopp, who lives directly opposite Lallana's former home in Formby, a genteel coastal town, is just a cool guy, he adds. You see him having a fag, a smoke, before the England midfielder moved to Cheshire. His young son, Arthur, would often wave at the tall, blonde neighbour across the road, shouting, "Klopp! Klopp!" imitating the coach's touchline fist pump. And Klopp would, unfailingly, smile back with a wave, to the obvious delight of Lallana Jr. Smiles and fist pumps got harder to come by after the turn of the year, however. A horrific run of only 2 wins in 12 games in January and February saw the team crash out of both domestic cup competitions. Fans awoke from their title dreams to fears of losing out on the Champions League altogether. The selection of weakened teams for the League Cup and FA Cup was the only way to approach such a spell of games, to get through it and the one that follows after, Krawitz insists. Getting used to a fixture calendar with no time off at Christmas has been one of the main challenges for the Germans. It makes a huge difference. You can't appreciate how big if you haven't experienced it yourself. It's really not funny. As embarrassing and disappointing as the exits at the hands of Southampton and Championship side Wolverhampton Wanderers were, they also offered up the opportunity to go away for a warm weather training camp in La Manga in mid-February. After experiencing their first campaign without a winter break, the German coaching staff had come to fully appreciate the almost absurd physical and mental burden of non-stop football. LFC owners, FSG, agreed with Klopp that the team should have 1 week together in the sun to recharge their batteries each year at the earliest opportunity. The trip to Spain failed to have the desired effect, in the short term at least. Liverpool suffered a 3-1 defeat away to Leicester on their return to domestic duties, putting in one of the worst performances of the season. Lallana: "The Leicester game, we lost 3-1 on a Monday night. That was a bad, bad moment. A bad result. I didn't see it coming. That game, you felt you had let him down. You know, you tried your best, but your best was just nowhere near good enough that night." Yes, the Europa League final versus Seville was disappointing, but they were fantastic. They have won it 3 years on the bounce. I will never get over that, but I can understand why they beat us, if that makes sense. Leicester was just really poor. Klopp, well-versed in navigating crisis, pleaded for a perspective in those difficult weeks. "We have to believe in the long-term project. Nobody wants to hear it, but losing is part of football," he said. "I don't care about all this talk about reaching a low point. I love driving to training in the morning and working with the boys, even if it's difficult. You can't give up because you're losing. You have to try again in the next game." He and the team had fallen victim to their own success in the autumn to an extent. Liverpool's winning streak at full strength had created the expectation of more of the same to come. But in the absence of the injured Coutinho and Mane, who played for his country at the Africa Cup of Nations, the lack of depth up front was laid bare in brutal fashion. The team's cause wasn't helped by a foul air of fatalism that engulfed Merseyside like a rank Victorian pea super. Liverpool, as a club, had to rid itself of the attitude that these types of losses were somehow part of the DNA, Klopp told LFC.tv after the season. He sees changing that defeatist mindset into a much more confident outlook as one of the main objectives for the coming years. He wants a bad result to be shrugged off as a blip, rather than being seen as a harbinger of inevitable doom. This club, and maybe the city, have to learn to take moments like that for what they are. Don't make them bigger. In life, you cannot ignore the negative things that have happened. If you can change them, change them. If you can't change them, ignore them. That's how it is. It's all about the reaction, in football and in life. If you get up in the morning and the first hour is bad, does that mean you go back to bed? No. It means let's try another one. After reaching a kind of nadir at the King Power Stadium, Liverpool's form recovered sufficiently to secure fourth spot, with an angst-laden opening half against Middlesbrough at Anfield on the last day of the season, eventually turning into a deluge of goals. Liverpool director Mike Gordon describes the 3-0 win as one of the happiest moments of his tenure. Finishing in the top four with this group that had worked so hard for it, with my partners John W. Henry and Tom Werner in attendance, being able to celebrate with Jürgen and his staff, you feel this happiness to the core. It was really great. But in hindsight, are there any regrets about a big opportunity missed? With the notable exceptions of Chelsea and Tottenham, all the big teams underperformed in one way or another. Could Liverpool have sneaked the league with one or two useful signings in the January transfer window? I would regret it if we hadn't tried to bring in additional players, says Gordon, having pondered the question very carefully. But we clearly did try. The availability of players in the January window is continuing to diminish. It's now an anomaly if you're able to do something. I don't know what it would have meant for the rest of the season if we had found the right solution. Would we have strengthened? Nobody knows. But showing discipline in the transfer market and staying true to your principles is really important. And that's one of the reasons we didn't add to the squad. We tried, and the same goes for all windows. We look for any advantage and opportunity to improve. Crowett says the coaching staff didn't look back in anger either. Are we upset about not doing better? No. Football is a learning system, a game of constant development. We wanted to give the many young players we had a chance, an outlook. Financially, I don't know if it would have been possible to make additions in January. Spending big money is not exciting. We have wonderful guys in prospect. Trent Alexander-Arnold, Ben Woodburn, Ovi Ejaria. We want them to have the opportunity to train with us and evaluate their true potential. We knew we didn't have any international games. We played a great first half of the season with many great games. In January, we fell into a hole a little bit. We got a little unlucky with refereeing decisions, and unfortunately we had some injuries. You have to factor them in, but we are, of course, trying to avoid them as best we can. We've made outstanding progress in terms of the players' athletic development, and we're exhausting all possibilities of injury prevention. Luck and bad luck will always be a factor, though. Would we have liked to win the title? Obviously. That's what we're fighting for. But we don't go around second-guessing past decisions and bemoaning missed opportunities. We take it on board and stash it in our rucksack of experience. And then we make all of that part of future deliberations. For 2017-2018, when Liverpool will once again play twice a week, juggling the demands of the Premier League and European football, players, coaching staff and the club hierarchy all agree that an expanded, enhanced squad is mandatory. We understand the importance of depth, says Gordon. It's not just about the best 11. It's a very long season in an especially demanding sport, and many of the best players also play for their countries in addition to club football. We need reinforcements. That lesson has become particularly acute and relevant over the last season and a half. Lallana's assessment is equally candid. I think we need four more top players. No disrespect to our younger lads, but if you look at our bench in the last 3 months, there are a lot of young players on there. When you look at Chelsea's bench, they bring on Cesc Fabregas, Willian. At times, just having them on the bench is enough to keep the players in the starting 11 on their toes, subconsciously, that is. Another 3-4 top players keeps everyone on their toes, raises the quality that bit more. And it's only going to help us. Europe next year, you're going to need more bodies. We've had a lot of injuries this year as well. There is no shying away from the fact that we need 4 or 5 more top players, and the manager understands all that. Jürgen is not stupid. He rotated his players at Dortmund quite a lot for big games. If he's got the squad and he's got the trust in the players, he will rotate. I have no doubt about that. Crowitz agrees. Rotation and a broad squad is the only way forward. That's the conclusion. We need to be in a position to be competitive in all competitions and rotate at a high level of quality. One interesting theory put forward by English newspapers was that Liverpool could have done with a more orthodox striker to function as a lighthouse during those dark days of January and February, an expert in forcing the issue when the football's not free-flowing. somebody you can boot the ball up to when your legs and mind can't make their way up the pitch themselves any more. Crowds is unconvinced. I won't deny that's an option that could work. I don't want to sound naive either. But staying true to your own ideas is important. You have to adapt them, of course, but you're still trying to succeed with it. You can't say, listen, lads, up until now we played one way, but now it's January and bad weather and windy. You should forget all of that. Let's play shit football and see how we get on. No, it can't work like that. There are many ways of winning a game. Sometimes you have to defend all the time, leave one guy up front and win 1-0 with a counter-attack. That can happen. But we won't make that a strategy going into a game or start bending our own rules. We have our own principles of playing and we don't give them up. We stick to the plan. But why does the plan work so much better against the best Premier League sides than it does against those situated in the mid-table or the bottom? Liverpool would have won a mini-league consisting of the top six, 5 wins, 5 draws, but they lost to Burnley, Bournemouth, Hull City, Swansea and Crystal Palace and drew against Sunderland and Bournemouth. Is there an argument that Klopp's football could do with taking its foot off the gas for everyday commutes to less glamorous destinations and learn to get there with a lower RPM? Lallana, interestingly, thinks the opposite is true. He blames LFC's troubles in nominally easier games on the subconscious belief that 80 or 90% of effort will suffice. It's a mentality thing. When your mentality is right, your tactical play is going to be better. The manager knows that, and it's not something that you can change overnight. But he's emphasising that we need to get that right. As soon as we get it right for those games, I feel we can go on and achieve something really special. If Adam says that, we're one step closer to illumination. Krawitz notes contentedly when the midfielder's thoughts are put to him. I think it's only human to think about smaller games that way. Even for journalists, I guess. You go to Aston Villa versus Burnley, you think, OK, let's check it out. But for Chelsea versus Spurs, your pencil is sharpened. Nevertheless, it might be forbidden to think that way as a player. We fight against that. We reiterate that the same number of points is at stake, regardless of the opposition. What we want is a consistently high energy. Having the ball and dominating the rhythm of the game comes with a certain level of intensity. That's just how it is. 90 minutes of football are A, unhealthy, and B, exhausting. That won't change. Former Liverpool defender and Sky football expert Jamie Carragher points the finger in a different direction. I don't think it's an attitude problem with Liverpool. You would never criticise a Jurgen Klopp team for its attitude. Every team can have an off day now and again, of course, but I think it's tactical. Liverpool's game suits playing against teams who build from the back, push up their fullbacks, and leave spaces to attacking counter-attacks. If the possession stats are 50-50, that means Liverpool have less of a chance of getting caught on the counter-attack. That's what seems to happen in the smaller games. The best two ways of scoring for the smaller teams are set pieces and counter-attacks, and that's where Liverpool are really weak. You have to address that. You have to change. Liverpool need to buy a couple of taller players, even in attacking positions, I think. You can also keep your full-backs back a bit more in some games to make yourself less vulnerable on the counter-attacks. Maybe sometimes it makes sense to let smaller teams have the ball, because they're not set up for it. Klopp's staff are very aware that set pieces have been an Achilles heel. Krawitz in particular is full of admiration for the high calibre of dead ball routines he's encountered in England. It's a tradition, he says. You can look all the way down the fourth division here and you'll find real choreographies, really good ideas. Every team has at least one guy who delivers really dangerous balls and 5-6 giant guys who will attack the ball fearlessly with pace and unbelievable power. The Premier League is full of these players. They might not be stars, but their individual quality is incredible. In addition, the goalkeeper is not protected as much as in Germany. You touch his shirt in the Bundesliga, it's a foul. Here, that's part of the warm-up. And then all hell breaks loose in the box. We understand that. We understand the importance of defending dead balls. On top of that, we spend a lot of time thinking about ways to avoid facing set pieces in the first place. The smaller side's ability to import an element of chaos into the game with simple but hugely effective measures might also explain why Klopp's Liverpool have found it easier, paradoxically, to play against the better teams. Their game follows more recognisable patterns, a code that the coaching staff are able to decipher and disrupt. Their programmes are hackable because they are programmes. The much more random operating mode of the teams below the Champions League places, on the other hand, necessitate a much more spontaneous and muscular response that Liverpool have not always mustered. As I said earlier, we are learning all the time. It's a process, Kravitz emphasizes. You might feel as if you're in control, but then the referee blows for a free kick in the 89th minute and the stadium is on fire and the pitch becomes a sauna. You can't ignore that. It's a huge challenge for us, but we are ready to deal with it, ready to prepare for it, ready to adjust to it. We know full well that we'll fall flat on our faces if we don't. Chapter 13. Small Screen Triumphs. In the years after Germany's win at the 1990 World Cup, commercial TV started taking an ever greater interest in the nation's favourite sport. Sat 1 revolutionised the way Bundesliga highlights were broadcast on Saturday evening by devoting as much airtime to the spectacle surrounding the pitch, players' girlfriends in the VIP seats, angry club presidents, managers' sweaty armpits, as to the matches themselves. The docu-soap format of their RAN show fed off the whole gamut of human emotions, providing storylines and entertainment that didn't depend on the football being particularly riveting. RAN's emphasis on showbiz elements involuntarily impacted on the protagonists, and even more so on the way football was being talked and thought about in Germany. Winners won because they wanted it more. Losers lost because, well, that's what losers do, isn't it? Players and coaches who didn't bark grandiose, adrenaline-drenched statements into the Sat1 microphones after the final whistle were seen as weak and hapless. They obviously lacked the confidence and mettle needed to thrive in an alpha male world. The game's transformation from the rather uncouth pastime of proletariat and other undesirables into a mass-market, compatible commodity pumped millions of Deutsche Marks into a sport that had never been profitable before. The deliberate dumbing down of its presentation came at a heavy price, however. RAN's version of the Bundesliga had a hollow centre. This was football defootballized, not concerned with the how, only with the wow. The wanton lack of any attempt at serious public analysis contributed to clubs and the national team getting left hopelessly behind over the following decade. It lacked the vocabulary and technical framework for introspection. I asked myself if anyone really wants to get valid information about the game in Germany, Klopp told Der Spiegel in November 2004. Does anyone want to hear, they shouldn't have run more, they should have run in a smarter way? I doubt that. Maybe on some niche channel in a program for exotics. The time was indeed ripe for a change by then. Within 18 months, the Mainz coach would emerge as the main beneficiary of football's analytical void and as a catalyst for a transformation, winning awards for his punditry and the acclaim of Franz Beckenbauer. But unbeknown to most, his overnight success on the box had been a very long time in the making. Sat1, the first privately owned TV station in Germany, had started broadcasting in 1985. Their regional office for the state of Rhineland-Palatinate was based in the capital, Mainz, and Sat1 CEO Jürgen Dürz was on the FSV board. When the club was once again struggling to pay their bills ahead of the 1990-91 season, the TV boss stepped in to help out. He made Sat1 Mainz's shirt sponsor. Not long later, one of the club's players started an internship at the regional sports desk, Klopp. He was already the loudest guy on the team. A world champion in talking, says Martin Kvast. Dirt said to him, Kloppo, if this thing with football doesn't work out for you, I'll make you director of communications at Sat1, no problem. Dirt's was quite serious. Sat1 was still a small start-up channel at the time. Only a minority of people with cable connections were able to watch the programmes. Rhineland-Palatinate's tiny regional sports department was housed in a couple of metal containers attached to an office building. It was staffed by a band of freelancers on fixed-term contracts and a changing array of students and school leavers eager to learn the trade. Klopp, who was always worried that his low-paying career would come to an end if Mainz were relegated to the semi-pro third division, jumped at the chance to test himself in the new medium after training and between his sports science lectures at Frankfurt University. One day, the presenter of the Wir Südwesten Thursday evening sports section announced to viewers a feature on the Roschinger sisters from Bad Vibel, the two most successful snowboarders from the Hesse region, by Jürgen Klopp. He had interviewed them, done the voiceover, and edited the piece. Quest remembers it as being quite good, packed with interesting details and asides. He was talented, and he had fun, he said later. If football hadn't worked out, I probably would have ended up being a sports reporter. On the 15th of May, 1992, Klopp's knack of talking himself in and out of tight spots delivered a genuine coup. One of the closest title races in the history of the Bundesliga had left league leaders Eintracht Frankfurt tied on points with VfB Stuttgart and Borussia Dortmund ahead of the final day of the 1991-92 season. Frankfurt's much-admired Fußball 2000 team of Andy Müller, Uwe Bien and Anthony Yeboah had a superior goal difference to their rivals. A win at relegated Hansa Rostock would deliver their first league title since 1959. Eintracht coach Dragoslav Stepi Stepanovic had ordered a media blackout on the day Frankfurt flew off to the northeast of the country. Everybody tried to speak to the immensely quotable Serbian ahead of the season's dramatic conclusion, but Stepanovic refused to do any interviews. Sat1 sent intern Klopp as their secret weapon, the guy who always got things done somehow. He had played under Stepanovic at Rot-Weiss Frankfurt a few years earlier, but his key contact proved to be Mainz 05 teammate Hendrik Weiss, whose mother worked as the press officer for Frankfurt Airport. She allowed Klopp through security and all the way to the doors of the plane, where he intercepted Stepanovic and obtained the only pre-match interview in the whole of Germany. That was his outstanding journalistic achievement, says Kvast. For Eintracht, the outcome was far less happy, however. They went on to lose 2-1 at Rostock in controversial circumstances the next day, opening the door for an unexpected triumph by VfB Stuttgart. Everyday life inside the Sat1 container compound was not quite as stirring. As the youngest member of the editorial team, Klopp's main task consisted of procuring a regular supply of cola bottle sweets from the nearby wholesale store. He was happy to do that, but he said we should make it a game. Everything was a competition with Kloppo, says Kvast, one of the sports editors on the desk. We sat there and threw cola bottles into each other's mouths from 3-4 meters, best of 10. The loser had to buy everyone else a beer. These scenes come to mind when I see him now, being the coach of Liverpool. After his formal internship of 3 months was up, Klopp kept returning to the containers to do the odd feature, or simply hang out with ex-colleagues who had become close friends. One of them was Martin Schwalb, a young handball player. He later won the Handball Champions League in 2013 as coach of HSV Hamburg. Klopp's witticisms in the flash interviews, right after the final whistle as a player and a coach at Mainz, made him a favourite with reporters from DSF, the commercial channel broadcasting Bundesliga 2 in Germany. In September 2001, Klopp and Ralf Rangnick, who were first and second in the second division with Mainz and Hannover 96 respectively, were invited to the station's Viererkette talk show to discuss the crisis in German football with 1974 World Cup winner Paul Breitner, one of the most prominent pundits. Following on from the excruciatingly bad Euro 2000 tournament, the national team was in acute danger of missing out on the 2002 World Cup after a nil-all draw in the first leg of their playoff against Ukraine. Breitner, at first, was reluctant to share the stage with Klopp and Rangnick, says Viererkette's producer, Jörg Kraus. They were second division coaches. What did they know about the national team's problems? The former Bayern Munich and Real Madrid midfielder, in the end, agreed to sit down with these relative nobodies. Prompted by presenter Rudi Bruckner, Breitner suggested a flurry of partially contradictory reasons for Germany's fall from grace, including too much pressure from the German FA, an absence of long-term planning by the authorities, and a weak mentality in the national Mannschaft squad. Rangnick, bruised by his infamous appearance on the ZDF Sports Studio 3 years earlier, when he had pontificated on the virtues of zonal marking and earned the scorn of Bundesliga colleagues and of all the tabloid media in return, was careful not to contradict the authoritatively suited and booted Breitner too openly. Klopp, 34, clean-shaven, in a student's uniform of a brown polo shirt, khaki trousers and trainers, could hardly fit his rangy frame into the leather armchairs. He was also deferential to begin with, even a little nervous. His voice, lightly charged with a Swabian lilt, betrayed a sense of unease in the opening exchanges. Rangnick, in a grey shirt over a black T-shirt like an off-duty graphic designer, and Klopp grew in confidence as the programme progressed. Between them, they quietly pinpointed the two most important reasons for German football's problems: weakness in youth development and the failure to understand football as a collective game. Young players get 10 hours a week training and the club caretaker decides if they're allowed on the pitch during school holidays, says Rangnick. We have to get them to train 30, 40 hours per week. He went on to explain that young professional players too expected to keep on learning their trade, instructed by coaches. who put on proper training sessions, treat them respectfully, point out mistakes, and aim to develop them further. Breitner protested that the Bundesliga pros were, by definition, so good that they didn't need to be taught the ins and outs of the game, least of all by self-appointed modernizers and upstarts who had never played at the highest levels themselves. "I don't want to put anybody down here," he said, feigning diplomacy, "but the individual quality of the best players is so high that many coaches won't be able to keep up. You learn from looking at your peers at this level, like I learn from looking at Franz Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller in training at Bayern. You don't need a coach to explain to you why you only hit the outside of the post from 20 metres rather than the inside, or point out a small technical mistake." Klopp was moved to object forcefully, but an advertising break spared Breitner the ignominy of getting contradicted live on TV by a bespectacled, profusely sideburned coach from Mainz 05. When the cameras returned, Klopp smiled beautifully and joked that the shooting technique in Bundesliga 2 wasn't that bad. "In any case," he added, "what's much more interesting is improving the team as a whole, preparing each player so that the combination of them all functions well." Klopp readily admitted that he hadn't been the best of players, more of a second-division warhorse. "But why should that disqualify him as a coach?" "Yes, I teach them more than I ever knew," he cheerily agreed with Bruckner. Getting Mainz to the Bundesliga and to a mid-table position without significant investment in the squad and almost no first-division experience within the team proved Klopp's point a few years later. Ever the teacher, he seemed to enjoy talking about his ideas and methods in public almost as much as coaching the players. "Most things I learned in life I learned because somebody gave me the right advice in the right moment, without me asking," he would tell the Sunday Times years later. "I was a lucky guy. I met some nice people in the beginning, teachers, coaches, and of course my parents and all that stuff. I think that's what life should be, that you make your own experiences and whether they're good or bad, you share them, so somebody else can avoid the same mistakes. That's how I think football should work too." Unlike one or two of his young, iconoclastic contemporaries, he buffered his mission statements with self-lacerating humour, carefully downplaying his own importance and stressing that of his fellow travellers on the journey towards a faster, more joined-up game. Klopp's enthusiastic dissemination of the new doctrine never crossed the line into self-aggrandisement or open disrespect to the establishment. Dieter Gruschwitz, the former sports editor of state broadcaster ZDF, enjoyed talking football with Klopp over a beer in a pub not far from the FSV coach's house in the suburb of Gonsenheim. "We would see each other all the time and started to become friendly," Gruschwitz says. "Klopp had this very winning, captivating way of talking to people, so I started thinking." ZDF own the rights to the upcoming 2005 Confederations Cup, held in Germany as a test run for the 2006 World Cup. Their friendly rivals from ARD had the award-winning duo of presenter Gerhard Delling and expert Gunter Netzer, the former Germany international playmaker whose acerbic wit and sometimes toe-curling honesty had brought a measure of relief during the most inept performances of the national team at the turn of the century and beyond. Netzer, a youthful rebel turned aristocratic elder statesman, if he had lived in Britain, he'd have long been Lord Netzer, or at least Sir Gunter, served as a visual reminder of much better, glorious times, and looked forever personally insulted by crude attempts at football that violated his heightened aesthetic sensibilities. ZDF's big name for the two major tournaments on German soil was Franz Beckenbauer. But as head of the organising committee, he would only be available for a few broadcasts. Gruschwitz: "Beckenbauer aside, we didn't have anyone at Netz's level, and we couldn't pretend to either. The only way out was to do things very differently. With a referee as an expert, Urs Meyer, with Jürgen Klopp as an analyst on a new tool, a touchscreen that combined video images and the ability to draw on top of the frames, and to do everything in front of a live audience in Berlin." Klopp didn't have to deliberate too long about the offer. "Gruschwitz came into my living room and asked whether I could see myself working as an analyst. All I thought was, I can watch World Cup games. Then I asked whether my two sons could get free tickets. He said yes. That made the decision easy." The ZDF executive had one grave concern, however. "I knew he could analyse a game. There was no question of that. But would the TV viewers believe a second division coach talking about international football at the highest level? Was the gap between Mainz and Brazil not too wide?" Beckenbauer seemed to think so. Der Kaiser looked a little suspicious and bemused by Klopp's studio deliberations at first. But after the second and third time he said, "Wow, it's really great. The way he explains the game," says Gruschwitz. A couple of matches into the Confed Cup, Beckenbauer was totally in awe of Jürgen. Beckenbauer's approval was like getting knighted for Klopp. "If the Kaiser thought he knew his stuff, he really knew his stuff," says Jan Derling, who worked as an editor on the shows. There had been no trial run. Jürgen just got up and did it. "He's a natural," says Gruschwitz. Straight away, no one was worried anymore whether he could connect with the audience. He could tell you about football without being moralistic or hurtful or being too scientific. Even a grandma understood what he was on about. At a World Cup, you don't just get the football supporters. Entire families sit in front of the television, including many people who don't really care that much about football in day-to-day life. He was perfect at getting the game's intricacies across to those people too, in an informative and entertaining way. That's who he is. It's a gift of his great talent. Klopp's smart casual attire befitted his choice of words. Interesting little observations. A left back was too deep. A midfielder had switched off. Were packaged into unfussy, un-TV-like language that didn't sound put on or patronizing, but simply like a clued-up guy talking to his friends in the pub. 25 million people were watching, but you wouldn't have known it from Klopp's demeanor. Gruschwitz. He had a lightness, an assurance, and an authenticity that immediately won over everyone, including Pelé, who was an occasional guest on the World Cup shows. He took a shine to him as well. What came across best, Gruschwitz adds, was the young coach's passion for the game. The combination of his antics on the touchline at Mainz and the enthusiasm with which he could talk about Costa Rica's formation showed the viewer that here was somebody who really lived for the sport. Klopp's relaxed yet substantive style of punditry changed the way we looked at football in the ZDF office, the former TV boss reveals. Derling agrees. "He taught us how to analyse. The first and most important thing I learned from him was there was not one absolute truth. You don't look at a clip and only see one particular thing. It's open to interpretation." He also said he had to see a game 2 or 3 times, that you couldn't really see things clearly the first time around. You might see that there's something wrong, but what you won't see is what is wrong immediately. "That helped me overcome my own fears. You can feel your way in. You can become skilled. You can adopt a routine. You can develop. It's a process, a craft, not a question of you either can or can't do it. That's what I tell my colleagues today. Video analysis is not wizardry. You won't be able to do it straight away, but you can learn it." ZDF's compelling offering, the perfect complement to Germany's unexpectedly exciting run to the semi-final, the fantastic weather, and the nationwide party atmosphere essentially taught viewers the same lesson. Decades of the kind of armchair psychology that involved vague musings about one team's nervousness and another one's mental strength, which had been the preserve of top footballers, was swept aside in favour of factual exposition of the little, tangible, readily identifiable things that could make all the difference. Klopp continues something that didn't exist before his debut at the Confederations Cup. "He simply talks about what's happening on the pitch," wrote Christoph Biermann, one of the first German football journalists to cover tactics extensively in the Deutsche Zeitung. Klopp's focus on the machinations of a match closely reflected his footballing education under Wolfgang Frank. "Everybody used to play man-marking," he said. The question, would this goal have gone in if that guy hadn't lost his one versus one, was relevant then. Today there is zonal marking, but many questions still relate to the concept from back then. We should talk less about players, more about the game. Viewers felt emancipated. They were given the tools to think about football in a far less abstract manner. By championing insight over status and experience, ZDF's coverage democratized the public discourse about the game. If a second division coach could persuade Beckenbauer to take note, maybe everybody could. But it went much further than that. Klopp's success on the World Cup touchscreen changed age-old perceptions about the basic requirements of coaching, Derling believes. If you had played first division football, you were meant to be a first division coach. If you had played second division, you were a second division coach. That's how it used to be. What Klopp did was to demonstrate in front of millions of people that knowledge could be gathered, that coaching was a trade that could be learned. You serve your apprenticeship, you graduate, you get to the next level, you take another exam. You develop step by step until you become a coach by virtue of what you can do on the sidelines, not what you've done on the pitch. A whole generation of young managers who'd never made it to the highest levels as players was inspired by that. Klopp's results with Mainz and his triumphant stint at the Fernseh Bundestrainer, Gruschwitz, TV's national manager, opened the door for even more anonymous coaches to succeed in the Bundesliga. Men like Thomas Tuchel and Julian Nagelsmann realized that their limited practical